This is R.J. Rush, Jr., EC Chair number 256, November 9, 1991. Otto Scott, Douglas Murray, and I will be talking now with Ian Hodge of Australia about Christianity in Australia. Now, Ian, you mentioned the fact of the early Parsons and how much animosity they created. It is interesting that after the War of Independence, it was precisely in the areas where there had been English rectors that Christianity hit a low ebb, precisely because it was the misfits, often the men who were alcoholics who would be sent over to the colonies. Now, a few years ago, one historian wrote a book here defending these English Parsons and saying they had been much maligned. However, his book was not too convincing. One of the things that very few people know is that the famous Salem, Massachusetts witchcraft trial came out of a church in Salem, pastored by a Church of England man who had been in the Indies, had failed there, and had come to Salem. And his daughter was the leading member of a circle of girls who were having these experiences. And it was due to the fact that they had brought up a black woman from the Indies who was into voodoo, and some occult phenomena began to take place. Well, at any rate, it's easy to understand that in Australia, where the Church of England was the sole representative in the early years, there was an animosity created. What is the situation today?
If I can just, before I answer your specific question, make the comment that I think it's understandable that the antagonism to Christianity goes back into that period. As you rightly said, the English, at the end of the previous tape, the English government had made some very severe laws for minor offences. And I suspect that there is within each human being a natural revolt against the harshness of many penalties. And what you had in the founding colonies, you know, in the founding period of Australia, of course, was that the church was part of the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of perhaps speaking out against many of the injustices which were occurring, they were seen by the early settlers of Australia to be the on the side of the established authorities. In many instances, the early convicts could get early release from their sentence and be given free settlement within the colony if they could get a good report from the local parson. So there tended to be, you know, a little use of the system there. Something which I suspect still carries over into Australian society. We tend like to, have national pastimes like, you know, tax avoidance and evasion, and anything to get around the system is pretty much there. To come into the current climate, to answer your question, according to recent polls in Australia, 75% or 78%, somewhere in that mark, of Australians say they believe in God. What they mean by the word, of course, is perhaps open to question. At the same time, it is claimed in the same report or analysis that approximately 20 to 23% of Australians attend church regularly. I dispute that statistic, not on any scientific grounds, but the sheer fact that if I take any representative area, I don't think there are enough church buildings to hold Australians, as one-fifth of our population would be in church on any given Sunday. If I was to take my own regional area where I live, we have largest Baptist church by Australian standards, and a large Catholic church. They probably seat around 400 or 500 people apiece. The Baptists have a couple of meetings on a Sunday morning because they're large enough. And the rest of the churches probably would be lucky to have 100 people present. The odd exception of that would be the local charismatic church, which probably has close to a couple of thousand people. That's about 10 miles away up in one of the larger suburbs, and it does accumulate from a number of suburbs in a geographical location.
I've noticed here in the United States, practically all the small communities have a number of churches and fairly regular congregations. They're not large, but they're regular. But they have a lot of churches. Ashton, Kentucky, for instance, has probably at least 20 churches in a city of only 35,000. But the big metropolitan churches are practically vacant. There, I think there may be an exception. Some of the Catholic churches have pretty good attendance. But in comparison to the population of the cities, it's a small attendance.
Well, Murphy's has 5 churches that I know of.
This is 1,850 people.
Yes. And there's a reasonable attendance at all of those. So there is a fairly high ratio of church attendance here in the mountains.
And I think that's true of communities of this sort around the country.
And it's true if you get into the farming communities of the San Joaquin Valley.
It's true throughout the South.
Yes, and the Great Plains area.
Sure.
In a village of this size of 1,850 people in Australia, you'd be lucky to find a church. If you did, it would be either an Anglican or a Catholic one, or maybe a Methodist.
And no church at all.
Otherwise, no church at all. And virtually none of those churches that exist there would have been built this century. Or at least later than 1920, probably.
I'm curious about this taboo in Australian society against discussing religion. Is this a strong feeling within the people in Australia, or is this just how strong is it?
It's fairly strong. We would find it very difficult to be open in certain areas of society anyway. For example, in business, you wouldn't bring your Christian faith into business too strongly at all.
Well, that's true here. I heard an exchange between Malcolm Muggeridge and William F. Buckley once, television, in which Buckley said it would destroy a dinner party to mention religion, and Muggeridge said, "Not for me."
Of course, any dinner party that Buckley goes to would be destroyed.
Yes.
The company he keeps would be very unhappy to hear anything about Christianity.
Yes.
Is it just that Australian society doesn't want to deal with heavy subjects, or is this such a personal issue with people in Australia that they don't want to feel like they're imposing their views on someone else?
I think your former comment is the correct one. I think Australians tend to keep away from the area because they are ignorant of it. They don't know the answer. And in terms of evangelism in the country, the successful people who I've seen church planting in Australia are foreigners, Englishmen or somebody like that, who have come into the culture and who don't have this inhibition. And they make very successful church planters, or the Australians that have been able to overcome it find that once you break the barrier, there is this emptiness in people's lives, of course, that they that they're wanting to talk about. I think Stoicism is probably the trouble. It's developed there for what reasons I'm not sure. There's probably some element of that relates back to the way I think Christianity has gone post-Reformation with the re-emergence of Neoplatonism following the Reformation that I was talking about with Dr. Rushdoony yesterday, or earlier today. The English Church, virtually from the time it called Charles II back to the throne, abandoned any kind of practical outworking of the faith to the kind, and once you start to read their religious literature back into the 1700s, you find this this very shallow pietism.
Sure, hunting person and all that.
Well, it may have been a mere coincidence, but I found when I was there a high percentage of the pastors that I met were of a Scottish background. Would you care to comment on that? It could have been just happenstance.
I can't comment on it. It's not something that I would have noticed or been aware of.
I think they take it very seriously, more seriously in Scotland still than the English do.
Outside of the cities.
Yes. I was going to say something here on that business of discussing religion in social settings. Up until about 10 years or so ago, as far as I'm concerned, I think that was true. But I find more and more that the subject comes up. It comes up more than it used to come up. And we had the same thing here, you know. Don't bring up religion or politics because otherwise there'd be a fight. But that was in the days when we had fights. Right now, they don't have fights anymore. You can bring up almost anything.
Men tend to fight only over religion, isn't it?
Well, men tend to fight only if they're serious about it.
Yeah. I think the Australians, we tend to be fairly... given to a dislike of hypocrisy of any sort.
Mm.
So the general criticism of the established church is that it's irrelevant, that it is hypocritical, and so we have seen massive abandonment out of the institutional churches. You know, the Anglican, the Methodist Church, which has now become the Uniting Church, and the Presbyterian churches. And the Baptist churches, none of them are really growing. Mm. The charismatic churches are the one who are accumulating the numbers, and yet our official statistics in the country for general church population haven't altered. Now, that probably indicates that the mainline churches are losing to the newer charismatics.
Mm.
Or it may mean that the mainstream are losing people who are just abandoning the faith altogether. And to some extent, the charismatic churches are bringing new people into the faith. I don't have enough information to be able to gauge what's exactly happening.
Well, I've often wondered at the practice of governments and sociologists in particular who accept the answers that they're given to questions. Margaret Thatcher was very smart on that one. They wanted to have some sort of a sex survey in Britain, and she nixed it right away because she said nobody ever tells the truth. And obviously we have, according to the surveys, we have an enormous number of born-again Christians.
Yes.
But they're not evident as much as you would think from the statistics.
Well, I would say Patterson and Kim's statistics, which were perhaps the most thorough, indicated 90% of Americans claim they believe in God. Perhaps 80 to 86% would actually call themselves Christians. But at the same time, they found that while there was a very high affirmation of believing the Bible from cover to cover, when it came to specifics, a very small number believed in all 10 of the commandments, and 43% did not believe in more than 5 of them.
Good heavens. Which 5 are one?
It varied from person to person in terms of their particular predisposition.
Yeah.
So there's a great deal of church going, there's a great deal of affirmation of the faith, but there isn't the practical application. I think Dorothy summed it up very well when she reminded me last night of this was in relationship to something we were discussing in the car, Ian, of someone we both know who became a convert and a Christian Reconstructionist as well as a Calvinist. He was in his early 30s. No one in his family had ever set foot inside of a church. They vaguely believed in God. It just made sense. And his mother's reaction was, because he had been the one in the family who didn't affirm a vague belief in God, that it was a good thing to believe in God. And if you want to go ahead and believe in Christianity and the whole works, okay, but don't get fanatical about it. In other words, don't let it provide you with more than an insurance policy. And she was really upset with him.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's a general, generally speaking, that's the case.
Yes.
If you take the commandment against false witness seriously,
yes,
you run into more eyeball-to-eyeball confrontations than you really like.
Well,
it takes people a while to get used to that.
And this is precisely why we are seen by the churches as a threat. We are shaking up the churches and the non-churched people because we say you take it all. It's an all or nothing matter.
Don't say yes unless you believe it.
Yes. And I think this is why, of course, in Australia, people are upset with us, as you found, Ian. Mm-hmm.
The anti-intellectualism, I think, in Australia is our biggest problem, in that people don't read serious books. This was brought home very much to me recently because for American readers, they might want to know, or listeners, they might want to know that I actually distribute Reconstructionist material in Australia. I import it and, resell it. And I have a small book distribution there that retails other books as well. But I was talking to one of the major suppliers in the country there about 12 months ago, about books. And he said, if you walk into a Christian bookstore outside the metropolitan areas, he said, you will not find a hardback book. And the next time I was out in the country, I took the opportunity to go and check. And sure enough, in the Christian books, apart from an odd Bible or an odd commentary on a shelf, they were all the short 150-page paperback books.
That's true here.
It is. It's not totally true, but it's true to a great extent.
What has happened here is that the serious books have now built up a major market through mail sales. For example, a businessman, Walter Hibbard, in Delaware, has started the Great Christian Books. And he does not sell the fluff if you order it through him, he'll supply it. But what he keeps on hand are books like ours and others and reprints of old classics. And what he's demonstrated is that it's highly successful. and Calvin's commentaries in various mail catalogs are selling in tremendous numbers in this country. So the traditional pietistic evangelical bookstore is still a place where you can find fluff and nothing more. But through the mails, the sale of serious Christian books, of reprints, is tremendous. For example, Lloyd Sprinkle in Virginia has been reprinting old Puritan classics and classics of the last century, and has done a remarkable work, so that his books have helped further Christian Reconstruction simply because he's putting them in touch with people who apply the faith across the boards. So we do have people like that. And of course, you're doing that now in Australia. And this is how it began here, through the mails.
Well, we're exclusively mail order, and even the gentleman you mentioned at Great Christian Books probably has a fair following in Australia if I gauge the market right.
Mm-hmm.
The easy use of credit cards across international borders has made book buying, from Australia to America, quite a simple process, without any extra costs imposed of foreign bank checks and things like that.
Well, we've had publishing companies in the United States going the way of the Hollywood studios, and they've been merging like crazy, so that there's less and less of them. On the other hand, there are a lot of small publishers that are emerging because they find that the big studio approach doesn't work, because it's and television is falling, and the movies are falling. In the last 20 years, there's been an enormous loss of audience for both films and popular, end quote, books, because the popular books are dirty, stupid, and they no longer reflect the actual American society. They're fantasies of one sort or another. On the other hand, I notice the catalogs I get. I'm getting an increasing number of book catalogs from small publishers who are culling out the better books and making a living out of them.
Yes.
So there is a, the pendulum swings. It doesn't go one way all the way. And the pendulum here is swinging back. There are more people, I think, more serious readers. Of course, we've got a big country, so we still don't have the numbers of readers that we ought to have. We don't read as much as they do in Europe, for instance. And it doesn't have the same effect as it does in Europe. But we're moving in that direction.
I think there's another aspect of the paperback book. If you go back, say, a decade and a half, which is about the time I started to buy your materials and similar reform materials, the publishing companies were small. The whole concept of reconstruction, of applying the faith outside the narrow confines of the four walls of the church, there were very few books. And what we have started to see in the past decade is a number of paperbacks of taking, say, your own Institute of Biblical Law, or at least some aspects of it. And now you can buy, 150-page paperback on Biblical View of Money. Now, that wasn't available, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think there's one aspect of the paperback market that you're starting to see a different type of book come into the marketplace, mixed up with a lot of rubbish. I agree. But there are the popularization of some of these books into the mass paperback market.
Are the Australian people content with the situation as regards religion now? I mean, is anybody searching or looking, or are they pretty much content with the status quo?
if I could take you out onto our beautiful sunny beaches with the surf rolling up, you wouldn't be worried too much about too many things other than enjoying yourself in the sunshine.
When you're in Australia, you're on a continent that is removed from the rest of the world. And when you read in the papers there about what's happening in Europe or the United States, it's very remote. And so it's hard to get very worked up.
It's a prosperous country too, isn't it?
As long as they're prosperous, they're not going to get too intensely serious. Of course, New Zealand is even less serious. It's further removed. It is off in a different planet almost.
Well, that could change overnight if the government runs out of money and can't keep bringing out the welfare checks.
That aspect of it is becoming a major problem to our government. In the, if you look at the demographics of Australian population over the next 20, 30 years, we have had, to go back a little bit, we have had over the last 10 to 15 years a doubling of the retirement age population as a percentage of the population, from 5% to 10%.
The birth rate falling?
Birth rate's been falling. The projections are that by around, I think, the year 2020 or 2030, that will be up to 20% or even higher of the workforce. So the government has a major problem of welfare on its hand, because welfare is virtually a guarantee in our country. They are moving to resolve that problem by now insisting that as part of the wages of most Australians now, there will be compulsory superannuation or retirement money. 5% of a person's wages will be paid by the employer into a superannuation fund. This is to get people off the welfare rolls.
Nursing homes and all that. That they're looking forward to that.
Well, before I just go on to that, the superannuation is the, at the moment at age 65, providing you have certain limits in terms of income and assets, you're entitled to a government pension check for the rest of your life. Industries such as the one I'm involved in have specialised in maximising the pension that people can get from the government by usage of the current laws that are there to get people maximum government welfare. What's going to happen is that I believe the government's going to force everybody into a national savings plan, which is the superannuation scheme. Then they will make it impossible to collect the lump sum of money that you've accumulated. They will force you into taking a pension, and of course a pension is taxable at normal income rates. Now, at present levels, we can take somebody in our company at, say, $250,000 of assets, produce them an income, combined income for husband and wife of probably $25,000, $30,000 per annum per year, and we can probably get the taxes they pay down to maybe $2,000. If that $30,000 came in as an ordinary salary into the hands of the wage earner, which would be probably the husband, the tax level on $30,000 would be shoveling around $7,000 or $8,000. And that is my prediction as to why the government's going to solve its welfare problem.
Share the poverty.
The problems that I have seen here, and have been personally involved in some situations where church troubles have developed, and in one I went to arbitrate last May or June, it was, where the younger generation, because of the kind of education they have had and the kind of world they've lived in, having been born since World War II, are really totalitarians in their nature. And they want a totalitarian church. And they either want to rule in a totalitarian manner or rule, be ruled. Do you have that problem there in the churches? Is there an authoritarianism arising?
I think there is. There has been an authoritarianism in some aspects, especially the Reformed community. You know, the older Presbyterians still seem to have an authoritarianism that really hasn't existed so much in the traditional churches. Our mainstream churches, by and large, have tended to become liberal over the last half century or so. And those that fought against liberalism, such as the Baptist Union in the state where I am, has really only started to become liberal probably in the last 20 or 30 years. On the other hand, just as a by comment there, we're seeing the one church which is reforming itself, which is the old Presbyterian Church. And our mutual friend there, Dr. Nigel Lee, is having a very enormous impact within that denomination to train young men back in the Orthodox faith. And that has reached the stage where just last month in the General Assembly of Australia there, they overturned the women's ordination ruling that came in a decade and a half ago. And now the official position is that in the church is that no more women will be ordained into the ministry. The authoritarianism has probably existed in some of the fringe groups. There was one notable group that broke away from one of the mainstream churches in the late 60s over liberalism, and they became very authoritarian to the point where people could not even relocate into a community where there was no, you know, denomination, where they had no local church. And they were quite infamous for their very strict rules. Although they have reformed recently, and it's been very encouraging to see that they've gone back to some of the people they've hurt over the years and apologised to them and tried to make amends in the appropriate manner. The authoritarianism has risen in the some aspect of the charismatic movement, of course, as you probably have here. But apart from that, Australians don't take too much to authoritarianism. We tend to be a lawless bunch if we can get the chance.
Well, the Americans have always talked about that, American independence. But since World War II, I don't see very much of it. We used to. Before the government created so many regulations, and before these social sanctions began to apply to the use of free speech, we were quite free. When I was very young, we were very free. But we really do not have freedom in the United States today. Anyone who thinks we do is under an illusion. We don't have freedom of speech, and we lack freedom of expression in business and many other areas. Men can be ruined very easily here today by either the government or private industry. Don't make waves is the national slogan. And I get the impression from what you said about the possibility of compulsory savings and all that, that a similar trend is going on in Australia.
The typical Australian attitude to authority is, you know, no one's telling me what to do, and yet the history of the country is that the government can tell people what to do and the people do not revolt. They don't complain. We are taxed at enormously high rates, and there is very little official complaint in the sense of organised. Now, Australians will do everything they can to avoid paying the taxes.
Sure.
In fact, there's a very good story, if I can just interrupt the proceedings with a little lightheartedness again, of two Australians who were put out of work in the recent recession and decided that they had to find something to do, and in the belief that self-employment offered the best job security, you're the first one hired and the last one fired, that they would go into business for themselves. And of course the only way to do this was to get tax-free income. Now the only way to do that is you've got to get cash in the hand. So they decided to set themselves up with a truck on one of the roads around the Sydney area and sell what we call rock melons, which is your cantaloupe, mm-hmm. I think it is, off the back of the truck and get cash in the hand, and that way they wouldn't have to declare it to the tax office. Now they were selling the cantaloupe or the rock melons for $1 each, and they were buying them for $1 each. And after 2 or 3 hours of this, one turned to the other and he said, "We're not making very much money, are we?" And his friend said, "No, what we need is a bigger truck." "We're going to make money on the volume."
Well, the West was known as the Wild West, the West of the United States. Although someone recently in a study showed that on a per capita basis, Dodge City at its worst was law-abiding compared to Washington, D.C. today. However, there was a fierce spirit of independence throughout the West, which was still somewhat backward as compared to the East before World War II. For example, when Roosevelt was voted into office, he carried with him men of like mind who were going to reorganize everything everywhere in one western state, which was a ranching state with a lot of one-teacher schools where all eighth grades and were taught. And they decided to close these down and have boarding schools and take the ranchers' children and put them in the boarding schools. And the bill was put on the docket, and on the day that it was to be voted on, the gallery above the state assembly was full of ranchers with rifles pointed down at the legislators. The bill unanimously lost. Now, that was the kind of temper that marked the West. Those, I know one of the men who was involved in it. Those men were fiercely Christian and fiercely independent, law-abiding. But they were not going to allow any group of liberal eggheads to destroy their families by removing their children from their homes to put them in boarding schools. So that spirit disappeared after the war steadily. I think it will return with a revival of the faith. And there are people now who, in one way or another, are defying church and state and making stands. I had someone call me a little before we left to come here who's fought church and state alike, and it's cost him $40,000, and he's not going to give up. It's wiped him out. But he's going to go on fighting. So it is because he's a man of strong faith. And I do believe as the faith returns, that resistance will return. And those whom I know in Australia who are staunch believers and Reconstructionists have that kind of faith. So I think it's coming in Australia.
Well, there is a rebellion of sorts going on in Louisiana. And the President of the United States and all the press is very indignant about it. Mm-hmm. The There was a revolution of sorts through the ballot box in New Jersey. They threw out the whole state legislature and put another party in, which has not been paid much attention to, but I thought it was very significant. And I think that if we run into rough times, which seem to be fairly clearly ahead of us, because the Democrats do not have any more ideas on how to get us into a better frame than the Republicans. If we have rough times, you will have a resurgence of the faith, because oddly enough, privation brings you closer to God, and you may see some interesting events here. The big point, as far as I'm concerned, is that you cannot win anything if you don't fight for anything. And a man who won't fight is obviously a loser. And we've got an awful lot of losers in the country in terms of their happiness, in terms of their spiritual values, in terms of their lives. If you get too many losers for too long a time, well, then something breaks.
I think Australia's problem, if I may be so bold as to analyze it, is like that of some of our states, like Oregon, which is a one-city state. It has one big city, Portland, which has an overwhelming proportion of the population and therefore dominates a basically very conservative and Christian community. Well, Australia, with its 15 million, has so many of them concentrated in a few cities, and they do not represent the country at large. Because I've been there three times, and once I was never outside of Sydney, but the other times I was. And you can see the difference. Sydney is not too much different from our big cities. But the smaller areas, there's a different temper.
Socialism, of course, ruins people's initiative.
Yes.
And we are a heavily socialized country. A lot of our problems in terms of the city and the country have been created in that as the rural community has declined through a number of circumstances, increased productivity, of course, being just one aspect of it. People have had turned to alternatives, and because they are not independent be minded enough to take the initiative and build for themselves industries, they tended to look for the government as a solution to the problem. First thing the government will say, well, you know, move down to the city where you've got more chance of getting a job. And so you've had these enormous concentrations of people into the city area, rather than what I think has got potential to become a change in direction of that, in the sense that we are relatively affluent. And I think the younger generation in Australia, and I say younger generation, I mean probably under 45, have probably tended to realise that socialism hasn't got the answer. It's probably curious that many of the blue-collar unionists, you know, the first thing they do is send their kids off to university who become white-collar workers.
Oh, sure.
And a white-collar worker soon realises that the way to poverty is to be a member of the union, where your wage is limited to whatever the union negotiates for you. In the non-unionized sector, of course, you can take a job and increase your capacity according to your own negotiating skills and your ability to what you're going, your ability and your job that you have. And I think we're seeing an increasing amount of that, of Australians being willing to take the initiative in terms of business. I think it's been helped by a number of American sales gurus and marketing gurus who have come across there, and people such as Zig Ziglar, who have really brought Christianity into their business marketplace there and waken people up that there is an alternative to socialism. And if you take the biblical principle that Ziglar puts it so well, you know, you can have anything in life that you want if you help enough other people get in life what they want, really is a rephrasing of the biblical concept of service to your fellow man in some form. And I think if that
if that could be established into the Australian attitude, I think this is the opportunity that the churches face in Australia right at this moment. If they can take the faith, make it relevant to the Australians, and I believe the Australians, who tend to be fairly pragmatic, will embrace Christianity. I'm very confident that Reconstructionism can eventually take off there. And I could tell you some interesting stories where it already has. To give one example, there's a young man who started buying the materials 5 or 6 years ago, and he's a chief engineer at one of our hospitals in the state of Victoria. And he joined the local Reformed church community there, and he became a homeschooler and an avid promoter of Christian schools. He eventually, almost with reluctance, convinced a local pastor that he had to do something in terms of educating his own children outside the state school system, and that pastor today is homeschooling. And the church, for example, now provide support facilities to the families in the area who are homeschooling, whether they be Catholic, Lutheran, or members of their own community, to the point now that the church is building a resource centre on the property. And each Wednesday now, we'll have about 50, 60 families in the geographic located roughly within a 100-mile radius, accumulate there once a week and participate together with sporting activities, and the mothers talk together and the parents talk together. At the same time, this man has gone into the hospital community, and our hospitals there are all government-run and government-financed, but in the current climate, the funding if a state government hospital has been declining. So Hank, in this case, has gone back to the hospital with a proposal that they start a fee-for-service-based service back to the community, providing one of these remote controlled services for elderly people where they wear a device around their neck. And they can activate their telephone call, which will put a call through to this hospital in Victoria. And he has been given approval to proceed in that direction, to provide a nationwide service back to the community on a profit-making basis. And he's done it because he's read the Reconstructionist materials and seen that this is the direction that as Christians we must go.
Well, when I was first contacted by Australians with regard to Christian schools and homeschools, it was the early 1970s. And by the late 70s, there were only a handful in all of Australia. And now the movement has grown very rapidly, so that it's important enough for New South Wales to legislate against. They are seeing it as a threat. So things are happening, I believe, in Australia.
Yeah, our problem really is the percentage of Christians in proportion to the total population. And
yes.
If we could increase that side of the equation, then of course we would see the Christian influence become much more powerful.
Well, one thing that has increased the number of Christians here has been the Christian school. A great many parents from coast to coast, out of disgust with the public schools, have sent their children to Christian schools. And the end result is that they are brought into the faith. As a matter of fact, the first church and state case here in this country was in the 70s, the Wisner case in Ohio. And they went after this small school. They told the parents to come to court with their children's bags packed because their children were going to be taken from them and placed in foster homes for their welfare.
Is that the Amish case?
No.
No.
It was an independent Baptist. And Bill Ball, the Catholic attorney, took the case and won a smashing victory. And that this was if they resisted, if they didn't shut down the school immediately, and they had a meeting. And the parents were afraid. They hadn't slept all night after having received the court order. But the one man who bucked the whole idea of his children being in a Christian school, a garage mechanic who was not Christian and had been hostile to his wife's faith, was the one who sparked the resistance. And he said that his boy had been a brat before he went to the Christian school. And he said, now he says, sir, when he talks to me. And he said, I'm going to fight for that school. And the Christians at the meeting were embarrassed. Here was the lone atheist in their midst, and he was going to fight for that school. So they went to court, and they won a smashing victory. Now, that's the kind of thing that has helped Christianity in the past 20 years grow so dramatically. A lot of the parents of these Christian school people have come into the faith.
The issue, of course, in the Wisner case, which you mentioned, if I understand it correctly, was the question of government registration of the school.
Yes, and government control.
And so far we haven't seen strong resistance to that kind of mentality. The Education Act in New South Wales, which I said earlier, which has brought in curriculum control, has not been resisted in strength. The churches that have mainly the smaller fundamentalist churches, which had taken a stand verbally prior to this about any kind of government registration, have all capitulated and taken what amounts to a government registration for them to exist as independent schools. But I think our real hope is the fact that as the state education system decays even more, because they don't have a philosophy of education that can work, we are seeing an outflow out of our public school system. In our state, the increase has been from about 23% to 28% of the population, of the school age population, is now in private schools, which are not necessarily Christian.
23%.
It has grown to 28%.
28%.
And we had Sam Blumenfeld there last month, and he got on the radio station from our home and mentioned his books. And for the next week, we did nothing but answer the telephone from parents who had this enormous problem at the local school, and they could see that their children were not being taught to read. This is the opportunity, I think, for the Christian school movement and the churches.
Well, what happened here was that for some years, they were ready to go along, because they didn't know any different. Then when Wisner resisted and others started resisting little by little here, there, and across country, people became ashamed. And people had accepted licensure, mailed back their licenses. And the resistance began to spread. So that now, the only way the statists can think of bringing them back under control is through the voucher plan, by providing a voucher for each student, whether they go to a state school or a Christian school or a private school. But since the Supreme Court has said controls must follow vouchers, they hope thereby to control them and bring them back into the status fold. So now we have another battle over that matter. But what will happen there is that one or two people will resist. They may even go to jail, as some have to here. But suddenly people will wake up to the fact it's morally wrong and that will begin to spread.
Well, the main thing is that the poor children will come out as ignoramuses.
Yes.
And their parents will realize it, and they'll just create a whole army. A whole army.
Yes.
You know, it's a law of diminishing returns. You cannot push around most of the people.
Yes.
And people get in positions of governmental authority, and they feel that nothing can happen to them. Well, history proves otherwise.
I think we've seen that in Australia with the question of the national identity card and the gun control issue in the state. When the people were pushed, they did eventually dig their heel in.
Sure.
It's a question at what point they will dig the heel in and what circumstances in the providence of God push them to the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time is nearly up. Douglas, you've been rather quiet. Would you like to say something now before we conclude?
Well, I just have one quick question. Is there a lot of home Bible study groups outside of the main cities where there are no churches? In the smaller communities you mentioned, there are no churches. Do people get together in home Bible study?
Well, I don't know enough to be able to answer the question. Probably in those smaller communities, unless the newer charismatic churches have made an inroad, or you have a, you know, traditional evangelical church of some sort. No.
We have a number of people who subscribe to my Bible study tapes and have home church meetings, invite others. In a few instances, they've grown into sizable churches. There are some who have estimated that the home church movement in the United States today easily has over 1 million people in it. So I think perhaps you could encourage that home church movement.
There is an element of it there, especially among some of the charismatic groups who are smaller groups. So it is existent. To what extent, I just don't have the knowledge.
Well, you can advertise it with the tapes and then encourage them to study the Bible together. This is going on among both Catholics and Protestants here. Because with the breakdown of both groups, there are many, many devout people who are no longer content with what the mainline church offers.
It's very interesting. Your taboos, politics and religion. In the United States, both the religious and the political establishments are falling. And you know, they're not going to fall into a total vacuum. They're going to fall into alternative movements.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time is just about up. Thank you all for listening. And Ian, it's a pleasure to have you here with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.